Welcome to today's 6 CEU seminar regarding ingredients for successful clinical supervision. I'll be your presenter, Michelle Lewich, and this seminar is pre-approved for 6 units of continuing education for licensed professional counselors, licensed professional clinical counselors, and supervising counselors in Ohio, per the State of Ohio Counselor, Social Worker, and Marriage and Family Therapist Board. So as we begin today's seminar, I'd like you to think a little bit about what do you consider the roles and functions of a supervising mental health professional? And maybe take a minute here, write down some ideas. When supervisor, especially in a mental health setting, comes to mind, what are the first things that you think of? Because we're going to talk a lot today about that, what those roles are, how best to fulfill those roles, and the liability factor about it, the ethical side of it, the boundaries, and potential issues in supervision. So as someone's going into a supervising relationship, the roles and the scope of practice should be specifically delineated or outlined. So, for example, I will use a general statement like diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders in a, and then fill in the blank, such and such setting. So things like outpatient private practice setting or community health mental health setting or hospital setting, whatever the setting is. And then with such and such population. So you want to delineate whether you're working with children, families, adults, groups, and then what type of work you're doing. Are you doing assessments in terms of placement or scope of practice? Are you doing psychotherapy? Are you doing ongoing therapy once a week or a few times a month? Are you doing a more intensive group, like an intensive outpatient or a partial hospitalization? So what types of scope of practice are you doing? But the key is putting in there diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders and what population, and according currently to the ICD-10. Now, currently, they want you to really specify the start and end dates. I know when I had started going for my supervision hours years ago, we just basically could say until we get our licensure. But now we have to say when the start and end dates would be. And then if we need to add more time, we can contact the board and they can add more time onto that. Now, one thing that should be self-explanatory, but I do want to just say, because it's worth highlighting, is that both the supervisee and the supervisor should only practice in the area of specified competence. So obviously the supervisee's in a learning position. They're broadening what type of populations they can work with and their effectiveness in that. But the supervisor is really responsible for making sure that if there's certain types of clients, they're screened and there's something that is within their scope of practice to adequately supervise. Another thing that the licensure ethics rules say is that we're not to supervise a family member or a relative. Another thing we want to highlight is that anything that the supervisee does needs to be co-signed, documented, or regulated by the supervisor. So that means that if there's clinical notes, if you're doing ongoing therapy, for example, with someone, that the supervisor should be aware of what's in the chart. He or she should be flipping through, reading the documentation and notes, making sure that it meets what's clinically effective therapy for that specific type of population. If there's any reports going out, even a letter or something saying that so-and-so showed up for an assessment or for a treatment session, the supervisor should be signing off on that as well. remember, the liability is on the supervisor. If something happens, eventually, and if it's under the course of supervision, the person who's going to get dinged for it is going to be the supervisor. So he or she really needs to be aware of and regulate that. There needs to be informed consent at all levels of supervision. The supervisor should openly acknowledge with clients the rules and limits of supervision. So I encourage people to do a little bio. Something like, my name is Michelle Aluich. I'm attending such and such school. The person that I talk to with regards to my client sessions is my supervisor, who is so-and-so. This is their licensure. This is where I'm at with regards to obtaining my licensure. So that people who are getting counseling, therapy, or some type of clinical mental health services from the supervisee know what the status of the supervisee is and the supervisor. We use this term in the ethical seminar about informed consent, and it's really not informed if we don't let them know the details at every step of the way. So we should be disclosing very clearly to clients of the supervisee's status. The supervisor and his or her signature should be on anything that goes out. Now, we talk about training agreements and reviews with the counselor, social worker, marriage and family therapist board. So the filing of that stuff is the supervisee's responsibility. What that means is a supervisor should be aware of what the board is asking for and what the requirements are and what forms or things need to go in. But if you recall, when hours are turned in to be counted for the board and the assessment of how the supervision went is to be turned in, there's that part A and that part B. So the one part the supervisee is filling out, the other part the supervisor is filling out and signing across a sealed envelope and giving to the supervisee. So it's really the supervisee's responsibility ultimately to put those together and get those into the board. I remember in the past I had a clinical supervisee who really wasn't such an organized person. And she even mentioned, well, what difference does it make if I send it or you send it? They're put together and the board gets it. And so I had to tell her, well, it makes a difference because the board says that's the way it's supposed to go. So I asked her, I said, you know, you have some time now, don't you, before your next client. Said, I encourage you to go right down to the post office right now. And so she went. But again, as a supervisor, you can direct a supervisee. You can give them direction and help with regards to what needs to be filled out or how do you talk to the board or what the process is. But ultimately, they need to be responsible for that. Now, if there's any changes regarding who a supervisee supervisor is or what the agreement is, the board needs to be made aware of that. One of the things that also in terms of counting hours is huge and is something that could be an ethical issue if it's not done correctly is making sure that the supervisee only counts hours of supervision by a designated clinical supervisor in their respective discipline. So, for example, just because I'm in a staff meeting with other people who have a supervision status doesn't mean that I can just count that as supervision if it's not my clinical supervisor and if the function of the staff meeting is not supervision. So we have to be very careful when we're keeping logs that we clear what's direct hours with a client where assessment or therapy is occurring, what's indirect hours, maybe paperwork or tasks around the office location, and what's really clinical supervision. So there should be a distinct period of training, a practicum and internship from a KCREP accredited school, and a degree in the area of what the person's going for licensure in. So back to that question I asked you earlier about what is it that clinical supervisors do? So first of all, one of the things that a clinical supervisor does is they provide training. We're helping to shape the skill building and skill development. And let me delineate between and differentiate between what these two are. So oftentimes, supervisors are going to feel pretty insecure and feel like they have all this theoretical knowledge in their graduate program, but they're not really sure how to apply it. So skill development has to do with maybe there's some skills they lack, and maybe we have to supplement what they learned in school or what they've learned in actual practice to this point with some additional knowledge, some additional role plays, some role modeling of some experience so that they know what they're doing in certain areas. Then in addition to that, we have skill building. A lot of times, in spite of a supervisee feeling insecure, thinking they don't know what they're doing, they actually do know something. I've had supervisees who thought they didn't know certain techniques, and actually they were doing something like solution-focused therapy. They were looking at the strengths a client had in the past and trying to build on those. They just didn't know the name, solution-focused, so maybe they didn't say it a certain way. Supervision that's counted for clinical supervision hours needs to be one-on-one and face-to-face. It should be instructive and didactic. At least 1 hour of clinical supervision per 20 hours. So that's something that a lot of times can be a challenge. I've noticed out in almost every supervision situation that supervisees are like, at the beginning, maybe they don't feel like they have very many clients or client hours. And I say, go ahead, get extra supervision while you can. Learn the techniques, get additional information, role model while you're able to. So we train. If you're a clinical supervisor, you train clinical supervisees. You facilitate skills for the initial session, ongoing evaluation of a client, and termination. We teach a supervisee how to conceptualize a client according to various theoretical frameworks. So with that would be helping them distinguish between what type of techniques would be best used for a given type of client and what would not be clinically indicated. I've seen some bold supervisees want to try new techniques, and I really want to affirm that with them. But then maybe not always know which type of technique to use with which clinical issue. Then there's also helping them bridge the gap between, like I said, that theoretical knowledge and that actual application of what does it look like to apply these skills. We also need to help a supervisee know how to personalize and individualize therapy to a given client, to his or her age, developmental level, maturity, if there are any cultural issues that are applicable. Because one of the things I've seen when I've done clinical supervision in the past is that a lot of times a supervisee would come to me and say a general statement, like, what do you do with a couple that doesn't know how to communicate well? Or how do you present skills to someone who's so depressed and has no future orientation? So you hear those are very generalized, but we know that every couple that doesn't communicate well isn't the same. There's different history. There's different individual personality variables. There's different things, skills that they may or may not have. Then looking at someone who's depressed, everyone who's depressed may not manifest the same, and they may need different skills. So helping a supervisee know how to start where the client's at and then go from there. So what we're doing ultimately is helping a supervisee basically demonstrate problem solving and client dilemmas. We're teaching job details and role expectations. One of the things I know a lot of people don't get in graduate school, but I think is a real important skill, is knowing the difference between how clinical work is, let's say, in a community mental health versus a private practice. So community mental health, you have a ready-made caseload. You're usually not going to be lacking for clients. You're going to have several people on your caseload. You're going to have productivity standards, and you're going to have to find a way to meet those productivity standards. But in private practice, the caseload may ebb and flow. There may be times just because you're excellent at the type of therapy that you do that clients don't know you're out there, that the insurance company gives referrals, but maybe their copay or their deductible's too high, so they're not able to come in. Or there may be certain times of the year that you see more clients come in or less clients come in. Another thing that a clinical supervisor, is doing is helping the supervisee develop an individual professional identity. Usually from day one, I'll suggest doing a interview like you would for any type of employee that you would hire. And during that interview, I ask about, you know, what made you want to go into the mental health field? And I really listen to the narrative and the story that the supervisee gives behind that. And then find out, okay, what are some specific goals towards whatever achievement of that professional identity is? For example, if a supervisee says in the long run they want to have their own practice, what does it look like to be building up their skills so that one day they'll be able to do that? If another one says that they want to start a nonprofit for a specific group of people, how do they learn the skills for that? Then we teach how to offer general emotional support and process variables. We're both in the supervision session affirming and using Rogers process variables with the supervisee, as well as showing them how to use that with the client. Because the fact of the matter is that the literature shows that even if we have all the techniques in the world and we're fairly good at them, what the clients remember most and appreciate most is that offering of emotional support and the Rogers process variables. A lot of times you'll even hear a client say, I haven't had anyone like you that I could go to in my life. We also help the clinical supervisees assist their clinical supervisors assist the supervisee in awareness of what clients push their buttons. This is a big issue for everybody, is looking at topics of resistance, looking at defense mechanisms, and how to react. Because remember, supervisees are in a position of being evaluated. So they're already pretty scared about, you know, how are they coming across? How are they going to be rated by the supervisor? But one of the things we can do is help tell them that we're all going to have times, even no matter how much experience we've had in the field, about clients that push our buttons. Maybe things like sticking to agency policies and procedures, how to use the Rogers process variables, how to de-escalate a client. Those skills are very important with the supervisee. Now, our supervisees, as we'll talk about later today, are at various levels of development. I've had some who've never even had any interaction with a client before and not even done a client session. And then I've had others that had licensure but not independent licensure. And so they felt pretty comfortable already working with a client. In those situations where someone has been in the field for a while, we end up collaborating more as a consultant to help them with problem solving. So we're helping a supervisee learn about the work of therapy and the tasks that go with that, how to diagnose and treat disorders according to the DSM, So differential diagnosis. That's something that can be tricky because I've noticed that past supervisees tend to hyper-focus on symptomology and specific symptoms rather than the whole broad picture of a symptom cluster. Clinical supervisors do a thorough psychosocial assessment. They do goal and treatment planning. And they try to do a practice that is evidence-based, that's backed in theory and application. And at all levels, like I said, there's informed consent. They continue to help the supervisee with professional development. They discuss implications of, if I give this diagnosis, what might this mean? How might it affect a client versus another diagnosis? Let's take, for example, if they're working with a child, that diagnosis is going to be carried through in their notes and everything for many years into adulthood, especially if we're saving and keeping track of records. If we're looking at developing a model for treating the conditions with an appropriate standard of care. So standard of care meaning what would a similar clinician with similar licensure and dealing with those populations do? Then we also look at how do you develop a treatment plan? What does that look like? How do you do treatment goals? And how do you reassess them? Because that's very important. We also want to make sure, in addition to looking often at what happens with the supervisee and his or her clients, at what is the professional development of that supervisee like? Are they doing good self-care? I've had a few supervisees in the past that really struggled with that. They were pulled at every end. They had so many internships, so many school classes, family stresses, and self-care was not a priority, and it showed. There were a few times I had to talk to a supervisee and even write down some notes or in one case, contact the program director of that person's college because she was basically coming in late for client sessions. She was disheveled and really having a hard time just juggling everything in life. So we had to reevaluate what her plan was going to be. We're also, like I said, helping supervisees to develop at an appropriate level in terms of their developmental level. Some people have had next to no experience. Others have had more experience. We're doing more skill building and affirmation. So we're helping them to become more adept at using their skills and improving their ability to practice independently. Part of being a good supervisor is really training a supervisee to know what they can or can't independently do. So it's not like the supervisee has to consult you for every little detail. They need to make you aware, but it's not like every decision you have to have the supervisor make for you, but to know when to consult. We also look at case review and conceptualization. I've known some people that prefer having basically handouts about all the different elements of a given case, and others it's more just an informal discussion. Of course, one of the key things when we talk about supervision is evaluation. At least that's the thing that the supervisees tend to most remember. So we're talking about several different levels of evaluation simultaneously. We're talking about a school. Let's say a graduate school or college is looking at, is the supervisee demonstrating certain techniques or certain skills? Are they working with certain populations? Then you have the board evaluation of a supervisee. One of the things I'll say is I've had some frustrations with the State of Ohio board evaluation because it's so oriented towards what happens in the clinical session with the actual client And the problem I have is, like I said, with some of the past supervisees, they had the clinical skill to work with a client. They did exceptionally well when they were with a client. But one of the things they lacked in was their skill with regards to self-care, with regards to time management. And those also indirectly end up affecting the clinical counseling session. Now, one of the things the literature has talked quite a bit more about recently is they suggest that there also be a component of evaluation of the supervisor or of the actual clinical supervision process. And I find that interesting because there have been more situations lately that have come to the board's attention where supervisors haven't been doing what they're supposed to do. So, types of supervision skills that need to be developed. Helping a client know when and where to use techniques. Applications and role plays. Skill development versus skill building, like I mentioned. Another one that I didn't mention so far that's really important is helping talk with a supervisee about how to build connections in the field. I know when I started out, I really had next to no help about how do you meet other clinicians. I know I'm an LPCC, and it's rather hard. If you don't reach out yourself, it's not like we do a great job trying to connect to each other. Especially, you know, I have been working in more private practice settings. So you see some people, but, you know, you have your few staff meetings a month, and, you know, it's very hard to make those connections. But those connections are very important for ongoing professional growth. And should an ethical allegation or violation come up, that's something that you're going to want to have documented, that you have been talking to colleagues in the field, that you are doing what similar people would do with a similar population. We also want to look at where is the supervisee at developmentally and what does he or she need. Helping expand their knowledge and specific skills. Helping them make decision makings and broadening their ability to learn. Some of the things that we may actually need to teach a supervisee include how to give and receive feedback. Remember, this evaluation component is huge with regards to clinical supervision. But you know, it can be tough sometimes hearing feedback because it's like the person, the supervisee, may feel criticized. So one of the things you may want to have is an actual concrete discussion with the supervisee about how does he or she present concerns to you? Let's say they thought about a case later after the client had left and they thought, oh gosh, I should have done A, B, and C. Maybe I should have written this in my notes. Maybe I didn't assess enough in risk areas. Maybe I should have handled the situation a little bit different or done different techniques. So I would have a proactive discussion with the supervisee about how do they give their feedback. So for example, what about if certain things happen outside the time frame of the scheduled supervision sessions? What is the procedure for contacting you to discuss areas of potential concern? One of the things we'll talk about after a while is a study that's out there that shows that if clinical supervisees felt like maybe they didn't do something as ethically or in terms of best practices, that they oftentimes did not go to their supervisor to tell him or her because they were afraid of that evaluation component. So I bring up that study when I interview a potential supervisee or early on in the clinical supervision relationship. I bring up that study and we talk about how do you give and receive feedback. We talk about how do you conduct supervision and ethical considerations. And then how to do documentation. One of the things I've noticed with past supervisees is with documentation, a lot of times they'll write something very, very general. Something like, talked with Mary, she had a better week. Her and her boyfriend were not fighting as much this week. She said it was much better and she feels like she doesn't need counseling as much. Now that's something that doesn't clarify what are we doing differently in the counseling session versus Mary talking to a friend about her stresses with her boyfriend. So I will talk with the supervisee about the importance of using clinically appropriate words, even in our documentation. So things like reviewed past skills with Mary, assess the degree to which she employed these skills in the last week since our last counseling session. Demonstrated how skills can be further applied. You know, so you want to use these key buzzwords that insurance companies would be looking for if they looked at your notes. Now, there's several ways we can evaluate a supervisee. Oftentimes, we're relying on their self-report. The problem with this is how does a supervisee really know what to be reporting? You know, if we don't give them a worksheet, they, can report whatever part they want to say. And that may or may not be the most significant part in their interaction with the client. So really, self-report only tends to be as good as what is reported. So we may need to provide some instruction early on about how self-report should occur, what it looks like, what factors are important. Then things like process notes. We should be checking a supervisee's notes anyway. And as I alluded to earlier, we need to be signing off. Usually the board will say sign off in the corner or initialing. So this one will ensure that there's some consistency in documentation. And we're supposed to be doing notes anyway. Can be time consuming. I know that's a part of documentation that or supervision that supervisees don't always like. But remember, as a clinical supervisor, you are responsible and liable for what that supervisee does or doesn't do. Oftentimes, we miss the essence of clinically what's happening in the session. So if someone were to, like a supervisee were to talk about their process notes, do they know how to bring up and what to write down? Now, there's other types of supervision that could be used. These tend to not be used as often, but let's say audio taping or videotaping. Things with those are that you can really get a real reaction. Of course, you would need to get consent of the clients themselves, and we would need to assure that the audio tapes or videotapes are destroyed, that after they're used for supervision purposes, that no one else out there can get a hold of them. So, for example, you can use those for many different types of educational experiences with supervisees. The other thing that's tricky about using audio and videotapes is that we're not sure how accurate they may be. I mean, think about it. How does someone act if they know they're being taped? Is the client going to really bring up their concerns as much as they would if they weren't videotaped? What about the supervisee? They might focus more on one area than another, knowing that that area is what the audio or videotape is going to be looking at. With supplies, that can be tricky. Do we have the supplies to do these tapings? And I found out that a lot of times, even though people can be real intelligent in the counseling and psychotherapy field, a lot of times they don't always have the technology know-how. So looking at the supplies needed, the data, how to know what to focus on, and again, it can be rather intrusive. An alternative to that, which also can have some pros and cons to it, is live observation. Basically, having a supervisor in a session. So if a supervisee feels real insecure, and if a client will consent to it, the supervisor is there to immediately intervene. Both the supervisor and the supervisee in real time are actually seeing the same thing. So there can be a level of insecurity, you know, with being on the spot right there, but it can also help to intervene. I remember one of my past supervisees felt like she was doing everything she could with a given client. And she said, well, would you be willing to sit in on the session and if you needed to intervene? And what was interesting, I ended up going over some of the same techniques with the client that she had. But I think because I ended up saying the same thing, and it was the second or third person who had said the same thing, and the way I presented it was a little different, it really finally got to the client where she's like, oh, I guess I really do need to think about that. I really do need to learn these skills. Then we have group supervision. Now let me say that group supervision shouldn't be the only type of supervision that you're doing. It should be a supplement to individual supervision. Group supervision is cost effective, and it's also very effective because there's a lot of commonality, that the supervisees may have with each other. They may all feel a degree of isolation. They may have techniques that they're having a hard time learning or modeling, and they can help each other out with that. They may all have some degree of stress from being evaluated. So there's a lot of things that they can bounce off each other and can have empathy with each other. Like I said, it should be a supplement, not just only having group supervision. One of the things that we want to make sure is there is time for individual supervision. Because when a supervisor is keeping notes of group supervision, they can have some general blurb about what they're going over with all the supervisees. But then they also need to follow up on individual distinct differences between various supervisees. Then we have live supervision. Basically, you know, where the supervisee can make adjustments as needed. In the moment, they can change things. So the supervisor is able to witness more complicated interactions and be involved when needed. The problem, again, is that with live supervision, we don't want to encourage too much dependency of the supervisee on the supervisor. Now, there's other types of supervision or evaluation, like webcam. The problem is that, again, confidentiality needs to be maintained. If someone's being discussed via any technology, we need to make sure that in case someone were able to overhear whatever, that we're talking in generalities. There are technical complications that can occur. And then co-facilitation is another type of evaluation where a supervisor and a clinician jointly run a session. They're able to help each other with that. One of the things that you want to be real careful about with that, though, is we don't want to give the client the perception of how much more expert supposedly the supervisor is. Because they might end up saying like, well, shoot, I'll just pay more and go for the supervisor than continue with the supervisee. Another method which I use quite a bit with supervisees was role playing. Because that way you're improving the learning process. You're able to discuss the pros and cons of different techniques. I'm able to see when a supervisee is role playing how a client is in session, I'm able to see what they think they see with the client. So there's a lot of different ways of doing evaluation. One of the questions that comes up in the literature is, can a supervisee and a supervisor prepare ahead of time for supervision? And the answer to that is yes. basically what should not happen is both of them coming in open-ended. The supervisee should come in considering a few different questions. Things like, what clients am I thinking the most about? I remember a psychologist in the past who had a practice in the same building I did, and he's like, you know, if you're spending a lot of time thinking about a given client, that should be a clue that this is really a trigger button to you and something you really need to discuss in supervision. So what clients does the supervisee think most about? What feelings, thoughts, or reactions come to mind? Are there any areas of uncertainty? What is it that I'm not sure how to implement? Are there any topics that are unfamiliar or uncomfortable? So some things a supervisee can think about are just the general dynamics of the case. Things like, what was the client coming to the session with? What were his or her presenting concerns? Because one of the things that often happens is we have a client coming in thinking that their problem or their issues are one thing, and then in reality actually seeing that something else is happening. Family of origin variables, cultural factors, unique personal variables. Like I said, even within a given population, let's say someone is depressed, that depressive people are not all the same. Another thing we may need to look at is values and beliefs. Values and beliefs of the supervisor, the supervisee, and the client, because those can clash. Ethically, our goal is not to impose our values and beliefs on a client. But clients can generally pick up on and tell where we come at from certain issues. And it can make a difference. There's a lot of literature that clients with certain types of values and beliefs, especially Christian clients, especially clients with certain beliefs on certain issues, may want someone who has similar beliefs to them to be doing therapy with them. So it's really important. There's times where we have someone who we know has different values and beliefs from us, and we really have to assess, are we the best person to be able to work with them? I remember I had a past supervisee who really prided herself on putting emphasis on the roles of being a wife and a mom. And we got a call for a session. This woman herself, that was going to be a new client, was a mom, was a wife, and she decided that all of a sudden that she didn't want to be married anymore, and she didn't want to be a mom anymore, that she had missed out on life, that her life was not what she wanted it to be, and she was going to start living for herself. So I had to have a talk with my supervisee at the time about, did she feel like she could really work with this lady? And she's like, well, you know, I'm not going to condone her beliefs about, oh, just up and leave, or don't be there for your kids, or do your own thing. She's like, but if there's skills she wants in terms of the things like, how do I get my own place? What do I do to access, you know, being able to go to college or get a new job or whatever, I can talk with her about that. So we have to be very specific and clear about how to address those values or beliefs differences. Goals. That's something, you know, treatment planning and goals is a huge issue that can be discussed in terms of supervision. Thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. Previous involvement in therapies. Collateral information, which is a great adjunct to what happens in the session. And one of the things I would encourage you, if you are a clinical supervisor, is to not just pay attention to what the supervisee says, but to also look at what the supervisee is not saying, what is not stated. Because a lot of times I will specifically bring that up and say, okay, I heard you mention these elements of your session with so-and-so, but I didn't hear about, and I'll mention some other elements. Tell me more about that. And then you can find out, is it that they didn't assess those other elements? Is it that they did, but for some reason they didn't think they were critical? Now, another area that we can look at is documentation and record keeping. So, how to recall important information from session to session. We should be keeping documentation of every session. And again, how what we're doing is clinically appropriate, necessary, and how the treatment that we're doing is supported by the literature about what's effective for dealing with that given issue. We should do some type of treatment coordination with other professionals on an ongoing basis. There should be planning for what are the end goals and reevaluating how are we going towards those. If there needs to be referrals to or consultations with collateral sources, that's something that via releases of consent needs to happen. There needs to be ethical documentation of things. And why? Why is this even an important issue? Because I know a lot of people, you know, they enjoy working with the clients, hearing their narrative, seeing the change. They don't necessarily like the part of the documentation. But the fact is we really do have to place emphasis on this as well. Because the laws, regulations, and institutional policies require it. I did mention group supervision as a type of supervision. And one of the things that group supervision offers in a different way that individual does is it assists supervisees in drawing on strengths and perspectives of each other. And what's really neat to see is when you have supervisees at different developmental stages that you can see them moving from that level of uncertainty and cautiousness to more independent decision making. Group supervision also provides a supportive environment about those with similar issues, strengths, or successes, and naturally provides a setting where different conceptualization of cases can occur. One of the things the literature more recently talks about is what type of supervision is considered more effective. Is it facilitative supervision or didactic supervision? So facilitative is more of a process-controlled supervision. There's mutual control. It's a reflective process and practice over what has happened. It's cooperative. It basically helps the supervisee develop his or her own style versus didactic supervision being where the supervisor is considered the more experienced one, the expert one. It's more of a teacher-controlled process. It's basically the supervisor coming in and saying, today we're going to talk about these cases. Today we're going to learn this technique. And it's very content-focused. So any thoughts about if facilitative or didactic supervision, if either of those is considered more effective? So one of these yields higher supervision or supervisor ratings, a reduction in supervisee anxiety, and a higher perception of supervision as an actually effective process. And that would be the facilitative approach. It's like, let me give you an analogy. If you went to your primary care doctor's office and they took the approach of, okay, you live with your body every day, you know when something's off, rather than them being the expert and just telling you, that would be more of a facilitative approach. And we're moving more towards that the supervisee know something. Like I said, we're building the skills they already have. They've asked supervisees what they think a supervisor should or shouldn't be. And I found this very interesting. One of the key things, which sounds like it should be self-explanatory, but hasn't always been, is availability and approachability. This is becoming more of an ethical issue because I've even gotten a email from the State of Ohio Board that says there's more supervisees that are struggling to even get the supervisor to sign off on things to reach them. So making sure supervisors are around, tracking and monitoring their work. So if they're in a learning environment, they're really wanting some actual feedback and guidance. They're wanting suggestions for improvement. One of the other things that supervisees are saying they prefer is making sure the discussions during supervision time are limited to supervision. They get frustrated when supervisors are spending too much time on agency policies and other related stuff that is not exactly involved directly with the work with the client. Supervisees also want a supervisor who can model and coach them about techniques, who not only helps with building skills, but also emotionally supporting them in what they already know and affirming what they're doing well, reassuring them in spite of their sense of inadequacy, and also giving constructive positive feedback, not just negative critical feedback. They want all these things. So it's real important if you're a supervisor to look at, where am I at with these? But like I said, especially the approachability factor. Now they've also looked at, what do supervisors perceive that a supervisee should be? They talk about psychological mindedness, openness. So again, willingness to hear some criticism, willingness to learn, interest and desire, motivation and initiative. So even while they might be at an earlier stage of development, are they willing to learn? Are they willing to try new things? Their enthusiasm and eagerness, dependability, curiosity, and empathy. So there's that skill of being willing to risk, to also, when they hear criticism, have minimal defensiveness. If they need to learn, is the supervisee willing to learn more things, to learn about more information about theories, to attend more trainings, to accumulate professional knowledge? Are they willing to take some time to do some self-criticism? And do they have a level of personal, clinical, and theoretical flexibility? Do they take responsibility for their own behavior? So let's say something might need to be changed. Do they take ownership of that? And are they an active participant in supervision sessions? Do they try not just to look at generalities with clients, but also respect individual differences? And finally, do they really try to look at how their own personal issues might affect the clinical relationship? When we talk about supervision, I also want to make sure that you understand we're making a distinction between clinical and administrative supervision. What I'm talking about today in our seminar is clinical supervision, developing clinical skills, promoting client welfare, assessment and intervention, whether that's individual or group, by someone who's independently licensed, and it's supportive and educational. Whereas administrative supervision has to do more with agency missions, goals, and policies. So that's more about increasing efficiency of output. A clinical supervisor may or may not also be an administrative supervisor. So think for a moment. If you were a supervisee, would you want the person you're going to for supervision to both be your clinical supervisor and your administrative supervisor to talk about agency policies? Or would you want them to be separate people? So what they found out in the literature is that supervisees were concerned about making sure that even if a supervisor also supervised administrative tasks, like how records should be kept, how productivity is demonstrated, that didn't overshadow the amount of supervision that looked at the skill building and development. That supervisees felt like what they're most getting evaluated on is issues of clinical interaction in the session. And since that's what they're most focused on, they really wanted to make sure the majority of the supervision time was focusing on that. Client rights regarding supervision. We need to also be training a supervisee about how to respect client rights and welfare. We talked about full disclosure being there. We also need to make sure that supervisees are not giving any impression in any way that they are already independently licensed. Records of supervision should be confidential and protected. So just like we keep records and notes about our actual clinical cases and interactions with our clients, there should be records or notes of the clinically therapeutic relationship. So something like reviewed with supervisee, different techniques that could be used for someone in a traumatic situation. Assessed whether current treatment plan best met the goals. Reevaluated whether such and such technique may be better for this given client than such and such. So you hear how, again, we're using those key buzzwords in terms of our note taking. And I would encourage not just a supervisor to have a file on the supervisee, but the supervisee to have a file about what they think they're learning, the skill development, how supervision's going, any questions they have. I think that's important because supervision should be a mutual process, like we talked about that facilitative approach. And keeping in mind, again, with the liability that supervisors are ultimately responsible for the supervisee's actions. The board is very clear that supervision needs to be one-on-one and be face-to-face. It needs to be direct. So even if you supplement your supervision hours with group supervision, or even if you are using some distance technology, that face-to-face supervision is what the board will count as supervision. Supervision should include ongoing feedback. It should be very clear that this is not a therapeutic relationship. I remember I had a past supervisee who struggled with self-care issues. And when I suggested to her that she may benefit from some personal psychotherapy, she said later, "But I thought you would be understanding, and I thought you're a therapist, so why can't I just talk to you?" We need to make sure that we are not conveying in any way to a supervisee that we have a therapeutic relationship. Supervisors should have the freedom for an honest evaluation, and that might include endorsing a supervisee for certification or licensure or employment, or it might mean that we say that we don't feel that they're a good fit. One of the things that I think has been most beneficial to me, and I wish I would have done in a more detailed, thorough manner early on, was a real thorough interview of a potential supervisee. I start, like I would with any contractual employee, at looking at their career goals and expectations. So why did you think you wanted to be in the mental health field? What is it that drew you to that? Tell me a little bit about your hopes and dreams. What would you like to achieve in the long run? And then hearing their goals and their expectations. What type of supervision they may have had in the past. And what they prefer or they don't like. I know for me, when I reflect back on my supervision, I've always had very nice, kind supervisors. But I remember one of my early supervisors who was very empathic, very affirming. So that I didn't lack in. But sometimes when I actually needed more specific direction of what to do in a situation and needed more help with problem solving and looking at individual variables of clients, I felt like I was lacking. And sometimes like I had to wait till there was a staff meeting to talk with other people about how they handled things. Another thing I'll look at is what areas the supervisee has demonstrated that they've worked with clients to this point and what they liked or didn't like. Areas that they're open to further training about. For example, I remember interviewing one lady who was a grandmother in real life, and she said that she loved her own grandkids, but she really did not want to work with young children. And so I asked her why, and she just said, I don't have the patience for it. So she knew she wasn't a good fit for that. But then I've had other supervisees who said they didn't want to work with children, but never had tried. And then when they sat in on a few of the sessions that I did with kids, they said, wow, I like this. I like the idea of play therapy. I like the use of metaphor. I like the use of the arts. I like the way that you can do some sessions with the child and some with the parents, or the different variety of types of techniques you could do. So I will talk with a potential supervisee about the different special populations or issues that we have, and what comes to the given setting we're in, what they have liked or not liked from supervision at this point. If they haven't had supervision experiences in terms of clinical supervision in the mental health field, I will ask them if they've worked any other type of job and what they've liked or not liked or what's helped them or not helped them. For example, I have some people who say, you know, when I have a question, I feel pretty confident about coming to you. I've been doing this for a little while. I don't need to be micromanaged. And I appreciate them sharing that. I also, in the interview, will share what my style is in terms of supervision and that I do feel comfortable adapting to different developmental levels of supervisees. So the supervisor also, in my belief, has some responsibility to the supervisee of disclosing his or her work experiences, what areas of expertise they have, what's not within their scope of practice. So I talk about what would be on a disclosure statement. What have I had specific CEU training in? What types of clientele have I worked with? As well as non-strengths. One of the top ethical things that I highlight is to know what you know and what you don't know. And to be ready if you need to refer out or to consult with other professionals when need be. Another thing that we'll talk during this interview about is preferred theoretical orientations. Now, most people that I've talked with to this point are very eclectic and really adapt to whatever theory might be best or whatever techniques might work best with a certain presenting concern. But I have run into a few people that really got their training at a certain type of school that was very focused on one type of technique or another. And so that's good for me to know up front. I've had some people that, wow, they were really focused on Gestalt techniques. I've had others that were really focused on systems, rather individual, or vice versa. So we look at that. We look at what the expectations are about what time availability the supervisee is able to offer versus what that setting would need or require. And then if there's any specifics about board rules, school rules, and company or agency rules, because all of those are consideration. So when I put together an initial supervision agreement, it has several factors. First of all, we're always looking at what's the board requirement for licensure or for effective clinical supervision. But I also add additional things that are specific to River of Life. Things like what scope of practice, what hours are expected, how they give and receive feedback, what type of payment they get or don't get. So it's more of a work responsibility outline and agreement. So here's an example that I included. You might put something like, this contract serves as verification and a description of the nature of the relationship between, and then who the supervisor and supervisee is, delineating the start and end dates, the purposes and objectives, and then the context. Is this a weekly face-to-face 1 hour type of supervision? It might include something like supplemental clock hours, but also a monthly group meeting. It would also talk about what clientele the person would be seeing. I include something like group supervision times will be pre-scheduled, but additional supervision may be scheduled as needed. And then I let them know how that would occur. Because obviously there's going to be things that come up that are not going to be during the typical allotted time. I include in the sample supervision agreement what modes of evaluation we may be using. Things like case notes, video or audio tape, live supervisions, co-facilitation or role plays. I also include how specific feedback might be given. That it will look at the supervisee's counseling skills, clinical documentation, and knowledge. And we'll look at things like ethics and legalities as well as just what happens in the clinical session. Then I also add that the supervisee will also be given the opportunity to evaluate the supervisor every 3 months. I want the supervisee to feel like they also have a component where they, you know, can look at how effective supervision is or is not, sort of like treatment planning. When you think of treatment planning with a client, it's kind of a similar parallel to the discussion of the supervisor and supervisee. So what are the duties and responsibilities of a supervisor? I would put those in there, and I would also list duties and responsibilities of a supervisee. So for a supervisor, I might put examine clients presenting concerns and treatment plans, provide ongoing evaluation, sign off on all documentation of the supervisee, challenge inappropriate approaches or techniques, or teach aspects of clinical practice, intervene if there's clients that are at risk, maintain weekly notes of supervision, keep a professional disclosure statement on the wall, and make sure ethical guidelines are being followed. Then things that might include for ethical guidelines of a supervisee are that they should uphold all ethical guidelines. They should be prepared and have thought a little bit ahead of the supervision session about having their client notes up to date, having the client files in order, doing associated tasks, having the board evaluations ready for us to go over, and having whatever supplies are needed for the in-person supervision. They should be prepared to file their training and agreements with their school or their board in a timely manner. Case notes should be done. And if they're not sure, then they shouldn't try and operate at an inappropriate level of autonomy, but should consult the supervisor in conditions of uncertainty. They may need to reevaluate some of what they're doing, so I also include in the duties and responsibilities of a supervisee that they would implement supervisor directives in subsequent sessions. They would keep a copy of their professional disclosure statements as well that show the supervisor information. I also will add something like procedural considerations. So if something needs to happen outside of the regularly scheduled supervision sessions, where would they call the supervisor? And then who would they contact if they couldn't reach me? If they had to make a quick decision, what would they do? Then there's signatures, there's details like supervision hours are only to be recorded between the board approved supervisor and supervisee, that what the rate of pay would be if there's a contract for payment of supervision, what that would look like. So the literature talks about qualities of effective supervisors. And again, I can't highlight enough, as I said earlier, approachability. If you're not around as a supervisor, that could become an ethical concern. And there have been more complaints to the board from supervisees not being able to find their supervisor or to get certain things done that they need to. Effective supervisors should also be able to model Rogers process variables. In addition to teaching, in addition to judging and evaluating, there should be some affirming, there should be empathy, there should be support and genuineness, and a way of giving constructive criticism in a supportive manner. One of the other things that oftentimes you don't consider is supervisees are looking at their supervisor to see how they're doing things. And is what the supervisor doing role modeling what the supervisee needs to be doing? So what a supervisor teaches a supervisee should be supported by their real life role modeling. There's in the literature an outline of what not to do. What causes supervisor failure? You don't want to denigrate the supervision relationship. Another one would be to not be multiculturally incompetent. To be multiculturally incompetent. That would lessen the effectiveness of the supervision relationship because we wouldn't be individualizing variables to each given client. If a supervisor really is unethical, him or herself. If we use evaluation instruments that are not correct or not appropriate. If we're teaching a supervisee that we're narcissistic and we'll do it my way, and there's that power struggle, that again would set things up for failure in supervision. If we're implying models that are not theoretically or empirically supported. If we're infantilizing our trainees, if we're making them feel small and intimidated, if we're colluding with them, or we're acting like we're trying to share our personal information in any sort of therapeutic way rather than in a supervision type of relationship. Or if we have a dual relationship with a supervisee. If you're dating, if you're socializing and things, these are things that you want to avoid. One of the problems is most supervisors teach their supervisees what not to do. And instead, a supervisor should be teaching his or her supervisees what to do. So let's look at each of these. So denigrating the supervision relationship. This would be someone who exhibits lack of empathy, excessively criticizes a supervisee, is emotionally non-responsive, and can be even hostile. Someone who's not multiculturally competent. This is a person who is not looking at all the elements of a relationship. The preferences, the values, the beliefs, the sense of community of what defines that person. When we're talking about multicultural considerations, we're talking about how an individual client views things. They may have more focus on the past, present, or future. They may have views about human nature being basically good or evil. They may define family different from us. They may have an idea about emotions being constricted or expressed. They may have ideas about whose needs take precedence, the individuals or the families, and how gender roles are defined. In multicultural considerations, we're looking at who am I? Who are my people? Where do I come from? What is my heritage? And is there a migration story of how I got to where I am now? Who is my family is perhaps one of the best questions that you can ask or try to understand when you're trying to be multiculturally competent. Who eats together? Who does day-to-day life together? Is it a nuclear family? Is it an extended family or a community? What roles and responsibilities does each person have? Even things like how much physical affection or affirmation is given, or verbal affection. I've had some clients who grew up with the idea where they said they didn't hear "I love you" until they got their first grown-up job, or until they got married and got on their own, that they never heard that between their parents or from their parents towards them. Role models is another way to find out what someone believes in terms of multiculturally. What's my story? Who will I allow in my story? And who do I learn from? So we should be continuing to evaluate our attitudes, our knowledge, and our skills with regards to culture. We should be relinquishing absolute truths, accepting multiple perspectives, and critically analyzing techniques and interventions to find what works best for a given client. We should be hearing how their views affect their interpersonal life. So if you are interested in looking at a video about what is culture and how to be multiculturally competent, please go to the website www.rolpc.org and click on the multicultural video, and that will also give you some information about being multiculturally competent. We also talked about things that were part of being of supervisor failure, and part of that was being an unethical supermodel. This means applying ethical guidelines loosely. It's only a friendly collegial relationship. It's not like therapist to client. So you see where it's real important because of the power differential and because of the evaluation component to make sure that we still maintain ethical guidelines. We should use objective, observable, concrete elements in our evaluation of the supervision relationship, rather than subjective feelings and thoughts. We should not show narcissism or acting like we know it all or we're the expert just because we might be a little more seasoned than a supervisee. One of the things that also would promote failure is if we applied psychotherapy models as if there was a theoretical or empirical basis. Supervision is not therapy, and we're not to use therapeutic techniques on a supervisee. Supervision is involuntary, is didactic and evaluative, and it's different than a client. A client may have to come, whether or not he or she wants to come, and they're being evaluated whether they like it or not, in a supervision context. We want to avoid infantilizing our trainees, acting that they need constant direction for every little thing, and that we don't need any direction. In fact, if we're a good role model, we will let them know that we hopefully are checking in with our colleagues as well, because that's what's necessary to really show a good scope of practice. You also want to avoid colluding with your trainee. You don't want to get into power struggles or making them a surrogate psychotherapist. And like I said, we want to avoid boundary violations. Things that should be targeted in psychotherapy include being competent, which means having an appropriate level of skill development and technique, supervising personal development, looking at their own issues, reactions, limitations and strengths, and how they affect the clinical relationship, and building an appropriate sense of autonomy. Theoretical framework, developing respect for the clinical relationship, and goal formation. We also want to help teach a client or teach a supervisee how to self-assess and bring up, like I said, if there's questions or concerns. We want to role model professional ethics. So some key principles that we need to teach a supervisee, and we're going to summarize this first session with this. Number one is beneficence. We have an obligation, ethically, to support others, to help others, to help our clients and do good through our professional decisions and actions. We also want to model for a supervisee the principle of non-maleficence. Now, these are not the same. Doing good and avoiding harm are not exactly the same thing. So we want to avoid exploitation and harm to a client. Fidelity. Our obligations to others that can be explicit are articulated in informed consent and obligations to be honest and to be caring. Autonomy. We should promote each client or supervisee's independent functioning over time and not engage in actions that will promote their dependence on us. Fifth is justice. The fair and equitable treatment of all, and providing all individuals with equal opportunities for access to care. And then sixth, self-care, the need to take adequate care of ourselves in an ongoing basis to help prevent burnout and resultant problems with professional competence while promoting psychological wellness. So these are principles that we should not just teach, but we ourselves should actually role model for the supervisee. Because again, they'll be looking to us and what we're actually doing, not just what we're saying. That's why having that supervision agreement, doing that interview, and then having those specifics in that supervision agreement is really important in my opinion. That's why I think the recent literature is also suggesting that we're not just evaluating a supervisee. Well, we're allowing them every so often to be evaluating us and to be evaluating the process of supervision. Now, when we come back for the second part of today's session on ingredients of successful clinical supervision, we're going to start looking at the developmental stages of supervisees, because it's going to be really important to individualize to where your supervisee's at a given time. Thank you. And we'll come back shortly for the second part of today's seminar.